Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. In Ukraine, the UN chief Antonio Guterres said that large-scale strikes by Russia on the capital Kyiv and other locations on Monday were deeply shocking and represented another unacceptable escalation. The strikes, which have reportedly caused widespread damage to civilian areas and led to dozens of deaths and injuries, showed that once again, civilians were paying the highest price for Russia's invasion in February, he added. Speaking in Geneva, Filippo Grandi, head of UN Refugee Agency UNHCR, reported that Kyiv, Dnipro, Lviv, Zaporizhia, Chernihiv and Odessa were among those hit in the latest uptick in violence after a key bridge that connects Russian-occupied Crimea and Russia was seriously damaged in an attack. This was another day of anguish for Ukrainian people, the High Commissioner for Refugees said. Mr. Grandi also noted that the situation across the war-torn country remains deeply concerning. At least 6.2 million people are internally displaced, and many more need humanitarian support, he told a meeting of UNHCR's executive committee. With winter fast approaching and millions of Ukrainians, especially the aged and disabled, counting on all of us, the UN Refugee Agency head cautioned that there were limits to what humanitarians can do. Heat waves already kill thousands of people every year, and they could overwhelm the world's aid response unless action is taken to mitigate climate change, the UN's emergency relief chief said on Monday. Without immediate financial help for the most vulnerable communities, the world is destined for a future of ever larger and deadlier heat disasters, Martin Griffiths told journalists in Geneva.
The humanitarian system is not equipped to handle crises of this scale on our own. To avoid a future of recurrent heat disasters, we need massive and targeted investments, especially for the most vulnerable, and we need that now.
Mr. Griffiths was speaking at the launch of a report published jointly by the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, and the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. It details recommendations and best practice from developing countries that have put in place measures to support long-term adaptation to climate change. According to the report, the European heat wave of 2003 was responsible for more than 70,000 deaths, beyond what would normally have been expected. The Russian heatwave of 2010 killed over 55,000 people, it also noted. Top independent rights experts appointed by the Human Rights Council called on Monday for the immediate release of Aleš Bialiatski following the Nobel Committee's decision last week to award him the 2022 Nobel Peace Prize. Mr. Bialiatski founded the Belarus human rights group Vyazna in 1996. He was first detained in 2011 and then sentenced to 12 years detention in 2021. Several of Mr. Bialiatski's colleagues remain behind bars. In a statement, the experts, who include Anaïs Marin, special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Belarus, maintained that there was a serious accountability gap for gross violations of human rights law in Belarus. Long prison sentences handed down to human rights defenders are emblematic of the abuse of the justice system and the impunity that Belarusian authorities enjoy, the experts continued. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Amazon, the seemingly insatiable megacorporation, still refuses to acknowledge the union at its Staten Island facility known as JFK 8, even as the National Labor Relations Board has rebuffed the company's attempt to overturn that union victory. Now Amazon has suspended dozens of JFK 8 workers who refused to go to work after a fire that left the air smelling of chemicals and many feeling unsafe. 10 of those suspended were union workers. The reality that workers around the country are, first of all, simply suffering too much to not feel a need to fight, however scary that is, and then many of them taking to hand the existing tool of worker organizing through unions and outside of them That's something that corporate media can't plausibly deny. They can underplay this movement or patronize it or try and confuse it by presenting it as emotional and irrational. But with tens of thousands of nurses, teachers, timber workers, nursing home attendants walking out around the country, the notion that this is somehow not meaningful, not about fundamental questions of human rights, and not worthy of the most serious, thoughtful attention journalists can provide, that should be hard to maintain. We'll talk with John Logan. He's been reporting on organizing in media-friendly corporate behemoths like Amazon and Starbucks for Jacobin. He's professor and director of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University. That's coming up, but first a quick look back at some recent press. 3 years ago, describing an Australian white supremacist charged with massacring 49 people in New Zealand, the New York Times wrote, quote, "On his flak jacket was a symbol commonly used by the Azov Battalion, a Ukrainian neo-Nazi paramilitary organization," close quote. Now incorporated into Ukraine's military structure and rebranded as the Azov Regiment, the Azov Battalion's founder urged Ukraine to, quote, "lead the white races of the world in a final crusade against Semite-led Untermenschen," close quote. Skip ahead to October 4th, 2022, and the New York Times begins its story, quote, "Commanders of Ukraine's celebrated Azov Battalion have held an emotional reunion with their families in Turkey," Ukrainian officials said, "honoring the fighters released from Russian confinement last month as part of the largest prisoner swap since the start of the war," close quote. Nary a hint in this piece, which includes a photo of a joyful commander hugging his wife, of the ugly far-right politics of this unit. From neo-Nazis to celebrated honorees, what a difference a war makes. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Between well-paid people telling you that the solution to high prices is unemployment, and the news of the latest weather catastrophe, separated by several pages from the news about how fossil fuel profits are doing really well, and then the story of the latest outright violation of basic human rights by police or by the courts, it is very meaningful to see news about how another group of Starbucks baristas or of Amazon warehouse workers has got together and decided to fight for better working conditions and dignity for themselves, and to encourage, by extension, all who witness their example. Worker organizing, inside or outside of unions, is the counter-narrative and the counter-reality to the corporate control and co-optation we see everywhere around us. It matters very much how these efforts are portrayed in the press. Joining us now to talk about that is John Logan. He's professor and director of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University, and he's been writing about organizing within the corporate world for Jacobin. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, John Logan.
Hi, very glad to be on. Thank you for inviting me.
Listeners probably know that organizing has been happening, but we hear maybe less about the lengths or depths, we might say, that super powerful, successful company owners are going to resist workers getting together to represent themselves. Well, meanwhile, we do see publicity for those companies all day and all night, you know, in ads and social media promotions and supposedly earned news by outlets that present a secret menu or a hidden deal as a news event. So maybe let's start with your recent piece for Jacobin on this. Starbucks and Amazon have been violating actual law, according to the National Labor Relations Board, in their fight against workplace organizing. Yes, it's not just distasteful. They're actually violating the law.
Right. You know, an important thing to say straight off is the law itself is very weak. So there is so much that Starbucks and Amazon can do to fight unions that is legal under the National Labor Relations Act. All sorts of things that would not be legal in other advanced democracies, but, you know, are legal in the U.S. But they're not just doing that. They're doing things and doing them again and again that are clearly unlawful. And, you know, in the case of Starbucks, the National Labor Relations Board currently has over 350 open unfair labor practice charges against Starbucks. And, you know, that's a truly a stunning number within a relatively short period of time. We're talking about a campaign that really only started in August of last year in Buffalo, in upstate New York, and for the first few months, really until December, January, was only in Buffalo, and then subsequently spread nationwide. The only comparable thing that I can think of is the UAW dispute with Caterpillar in the 1990s, where eventually there were over 400 unfair labor practice charges, allegations against Caterpillar. But that campaign took place over a 7 or 8 year period. So Starbucks, you know, is really just operating as if the law does not apply to it. What happens is that, you know, Starbucks violates the law. In Buffalo alone, the regional director in Buffalo issued a complaint against Starbucks in May, saying that Starbucks had committed almost 300 individual violations of federal labor law in Buffalo alone in a three-month period leading up to the first elections in December. The company is alleged to have fired over 100 pro-union baristas. It has closed union stores in Buffalo, in Ithaca, New York, in Seattle, in Portland, and unionizing stores and other places. But this is a remarkable union campaign that's now spread to over 240 Starbucks stores around the country have voted to unionize. But there's no question, if it were not for this sort of rampant, unlawful union-busting practices, it would be 2,000 or 3,000. It would be far, far more stores. The one thing that Starbucks did that had the greatest impact is in April, it announced that it was going to increase wages and benefits, but only for non-union stores. If you had voted to unionize or if you were engaged in organizing, you would not be getting these new benefits and wages. And finally, it implemented these in August. Later in August, the NLRB said this was unlawful. This was clearly designed to create a chilling atmosphere and to discourage workers from becoming involved in the nationwide organizing campaign. What did Starbucks do? It said, we think that is wrong. We're going to fight it. And then in September, it announced yet another wave of increased benefits that apply only to non-union workers. And, you know, with Amazon, Amazon is still contesting the result of the historic victory of the Amazon Labor Union in Staten Island on April 1st. Amazon is still not accepting that result. The NLRB recommended that Amazon's election objections be dismissed in their entirety. I mean, they were the most frivolous objections, many of them. They were all thoroughly investigated. They were all dismissed. Amazon has said, we don't accept that. It now goes to the regional director. Regional director will undoubtedly agree with the hearing officer. Amazon will then appeal it to the full board in Washington, D.C. Because it's objections and not a complaint, they can't appeal to the federal courts immediately, but they can simply refuse to bargain on the basis of they don't accept the election result. Then the union has to make a complaint. The NLRB would come out with a bargaining order. Amazon can say, we're still not bargaining because we don't accept the election was fair. And so the board would have to go to the courts to enforce the bargaining order. All of this will take months, if not years. Right. And Amazon and Starbucks know that time is on their side. time is not on the side of pro-union workers. So Andy Jassy, the new CEO of Amazon, has already said this is going to be a really long fight over the election result, not over anything else, but over accepting the election result, where workers very clearly voted to support the Amazon labor union. And he said, you know, the NLRB is not going to rule against itself, meaning they're going to take this all the way to the courts. And so what that means, and, you know, I apologize for going on. What it means is that Amazon and Starbucks can win by losing at the NLRB. I mean, simply because of their resources, because of their determination to fight to the death, because of their ability to appeal and delay at every stage, even if every decision goes against them, which almost certainly it will, they can still undermine these union campaigns simply by using months and months and years of delay.
Well, it's exactly as you've reported. Momentum is an important force for folks who are doing any kind of social activism, organizing, momentum, feeling that you've got the wind at your back. And so these deep pockets, this is where that money comes in, to just delay and delay and delay. And there's an expression that we hear from corporations sometimes, or their lobbyists, that they talk about skating where the puck's going to be. In other words, the law is not on their side, and they know it. But they are confident in their ability to either draw it out long enough or to actually get their legislative, you know, arms at work in bending the law. So in other words, they can just de facto live the conditions that they want to live, while workers are really on the edge and are really, in the example of Amazon that you cite, they've won this election, and yet they still have to go to work knowing that management hates them and is trying to take away what they've won. I just, to bring it to media, I feel like if media would tell the story from a different perspective, it would change a lot.
Yes. And, you know, there has been some good media coverage of these stories. I mean, the problem is it's all very fragmented.
Yeah.
You know, we need stories that explain the Amazon labor union story and the Starbucks Workers United story in their entirety, and the myriad of unfair labor practice charges, of unlawful behavior that they have been subjected to by these companies, and how that, you know, makes it virtually impossible for pro-union workers to get a fair choice, as the law demands that they get when they're up against these companies. As you said, you know, Amazon has 150% turnover rate in many of its warehouses, an entirely new workforce every 9 months or so. It's deliberately trying to drive pro-union workers out of the workplace. Starbucks is doing the same. It's firing them. It's reducing their hours. It's, you know, introducing new scheduling policies that are targeted in a way that pro-union workers will be driven out of the workplace. So, you know, they're delaying recognizing unions, they're delaying bargaining with unions, and all the time the retaliation against the union busting doesn't get better after the union wins. The union busting actually gets worse after the union wins. So it's just a very clear indication that they think the choice on whether or not a union comes into Amazon or Starbucks should be made by them, should be made by Howard Schultz, the CEO, interim CEO of Starbucks, or Andy Jassy, the CEO of Amazon. The law says it's the workers who are supposed to decide. But they don't accept that. You know, they think they should ultimately make the decision. And they have even said so explicitly in an interview with the New York Times. Howard Schultz said that he would never engage, never, that was his word, he would never engage with the union because the customer experience would be undermined if a third party, as he sees it, were to come into the stores. But the law doesn't say, I don't accept that the customer experience would be undermined in any way. But even if that were true, which is not, even if it were true, the law says that's not the point. The point is, it's the worker's choice whether they want union representation. It's not his choice. It's not to do with the customer experience. It's what to do with the workers want. And a lot of these Amazon workers and Starbucks workers have stood up for their right to unionize heroically, but you shouldn't have to be a hero in order to exercise what is supposed to be a federally protected right.
Absolutely. Well, let's get into Howard Schultz's rhetoric just for a minute, you know, because these companies, they have image management as a fully funded department, right?
Yep. Yep.
So you would hope that reporters would have their guard up, you know, recognizing mm-hmm. that. So you hear workers described as partners, and why would you bring in outside agents to disrupt our relationship? You know, never mind that the union busters never come from the place where the organizing drive is. They're always brought in on a plane, but you know, okay.
Yeah.
It's all such horse hockey. It's such gaslighting about what the actual worker-owner relationship is about. And my feeling is that corporate media propagate that line, frankly, when they not just report earnestly on owner rhetoric about partners, but also when they report these issues as though workers and consumers were different populations with different interests, you know.
Right.
That seems to me a yeah. fundamental failure of reporting here.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And, you know, and if you look at Starbucks, Starbucks is spending tens of millions of dollars in this anti-union campaign, is using the country's largest, in fact, the world's largest so-called union avoidance law firm, Littler Mendelsohn. You know, scores of Littler attorneys all over the country, you're trying to undermine workers' right to choose a union. It's also using the world's largest PR firm, Edelman, to help with its anti-union messaging. And as you say, you know, to talk about these unions as third parties, I mean, of course, we know, you know, that's never true. It's just always the line anti-union corporations have used. But in these particular campaigns, it could not be more clearly nonsense. I mean, Amazon Labor Union didn't exist 2 years ago. It was formed by Chris Malls, who was sacked for protesting inadequate COVID safety precautions. The lead organizers were all Amazon workers inside the JFK 8 Staten Island facility. The workers are the union in a very, very real sense. The union is not an outside party. Same thing with Starbucks Workers United. The reason that union, which is affiliated with an established union, Workers United, but the only reason it's had such incredible success is because of the dynamism of its sort of intrepid worker organizers, Starbucks workers who are organizing their own stores all across the country. And so, you know, you could not have clearer cases where you have these multi-billion dollar corporations spending tens of millions of dollars on trying to prevent workers from exercising what's supposed to be a federally protected right, whereas on the other side, you have workers inside warehouses, inside coffee shops, talking to each other and talking about the benefits of having an independent voice and how that's necessary to get respect and dignity at work. But as you said, to have any stories in which you give Starbucks and Amazon any kind of credibility in their anti-union statements in these cases is just truly ridiculous, because we know what's happening here. We know that these are grassroots organizing campaigns. Workers who earn $15, $17, $18 an hour, maybe at Amazon, against multi-billion dollar corporations who will spend whatever is necessary and who have unbelievable expertise, sophistication, and a total disregard for the law. They will do anything they can. If they can break the union legally, they would probably do so. But they don't care. Their only objective is to keep the union out. And so if it takes committing, in the case of Starbucks, hundreds and hundreds of violations of federal labor law, the penalties for doing so are absolutely meaningless. So they will do that. that is so clearly the case with these campaigns.
And yet in the face of that, and that's where I want to go to, because it seems to me that just more and more people are just not falling for that bluff.
Yes.
I wish media would take seriously this kind of nice job you got there. Shame if anything were to happen to it. But in the face of that, and in the face of the news coverage that says Amazon, for example, is a genius company, you know, that's capitalism doing what it should. And that separated, as you call out, separated from a story that they might also do about, you know, how Amazon workers have to pee in a jar, you know, but it's still a separate story from, isn't Amazon a fantastic example of what we want from companies? Nevertheless, support for labor unions is growing.
Yep.
Union election petitions are growing. Strikes are growing.
Yep.
People are ceasing to fall for it. So let's maybe end with that, just like it's happening anyway, and then maybe your thoughts about how journalism could help rather than hinder.
Well, you know, we don't even need journalism that's cheerleading for the unions. We just need journalism that explains what happens, you know, the incredible pressures that American workers are subjected to when they try to exercise their legal right to form a union at companies like Starbucks and like Amazon. And, you know, the entire labor movement does owe a great debt of gratitude to these workers involved in these two campaigns.
Yeah.
Because as you said, it has spread, you know, to Trader Joe's, to REI, to Apple retail stores, to Chipotle, to other places, to Home Depot, we heard most recently. But what it does is it gives people an education in how our labor laws don't work. More people are engaged with the issues than has been true for decades. As you said, in the most recent Gallup poll on this, 71% of the American public approve of unions, even higher numbers amongst young workers. And that, despite the organizational weakness of unions, you know, despite the fact that unions only represent 6.1% in the private sector, the last time unions had that level of public approval was 1965, but unions represented almost 30% of the workforce back then. And so, you know, we see it very clearly amongst young workers. Overwhelmingly, young workers approve of unions, but they have really, really low rates of union membership. And that's because young workers work overwhelmingly in what I would call young workplaces, places like Starbucks, places like REI, places like Trader Joe's. And those workplaces are overwhelmingly non-union. And because of the weak laws, and particularly because of the incredibly strong employer corporate opposition, it's very difficult for them to form unions in those workplaces. But you, as you said, despite that, we now have a wave of organizing throughout the country. People are taking inspiration from the union victories at Amazon and at Starbucks. They're thinking, we should do that in our own workplace. We don't just have to quit. We can stick around and organize and try to win respect and dignity at work. And so a lot of these campaigns will not be successful because they're all David versus Goliath stories. There's another Amazon labor union election in Albany next week. I'm hopeful, but we don't know what the outcome will be. But it would be a remarkable win, again, if they were to win in Albany. But despite that, you know, something historic is changing. You have, as you said, the growing number of people talking union, Amazon workers, Starbucks workers, museum workers, nonprofit workers, gallery workers, online media workers, is growing. More people are paying attention to labor issues. Something has changed as a result of the pandemic. We don't know what the legacy of these particular campaigns is going to be, but I think there's very good reason to believe that the labor movement as a process, you know, process by which people get together collectively to win dignity and respect at the workplace, these movements at Starbucks and Amazon has shown there's still a great deal of life left in that process.
All right, we're going to end on that note. We've been speaking with John Logan. He's professor and director of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University. You can find his work on 21st century organizing at jacobin.org. John Logan, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me on. It was a pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. If you'd like more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, fair.org. That's also a place to find previous Counterspin shows and transcripts, or to sign up for our Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Coming up tomorrow on Radio Free Kansas.
The National Weather Service reported the Springfield Twister was the biggest storm to pass through central Illinois in a decade.
The West Texas wildfires have scorched so much land that it's like watching more than half of Rhode Island burn.
Biggest one I've ever seen.
I love to drive. You could say I'm an autoholic. My life began in a car, so Dad tells me. I discovered sex in the backseat, too. Made my own kid there. I may die out on the road. When things get boring, I drive around looking for something else. And if it's no good here, I go there. Too hot? We'll just go north into the hills. Too cold? Off south, just like the birds. Sometimes, I don't even know why I'm going. I'm just out there on the road, rambling around. I've just got to get out there and drive, maybe for a day or two, and see some country, some trees. I need to see nature. I've worked in vehicles and slept in them, even lived in one. Can't count all the hours I've just waited somewhere with the motor running, for red light, for traffic to move, for somebody to come out, for anything. Who even hears the motor running there under your thoughts? Vibration is good, moves the blood around. We don't even smell these engines unless something's broken. I've driven them all. Motorcycles, three-wheelers, minis, SUVs, compacts, pickups, a limousine, a truck, tractors, golf carts, you name it. If it's got a motor, that's good for me. And the power. The roar, the jolt of energy, the thrill of speed. I've got this armored steel that can run away, or run over, or damn near fly. My ride talks for me, tells you who I am. Without it, I'd just be a naked little animal out there in the rain and snow, like a snail without a shell. Likely I wouldn't kill for fuel, but my taxes pay for soldiers who will, by God. Gotta have gas. And if by accident I had to run over some kid, heaven forbid, or some old fart, I may lose my license for a little while. But I'll keep driving. We all need to get around. Okay, the weather is getting really weird. You never know what might happen. If this place floods or burns, I'll toss my stuff in here and go somewhere better. I'm not walking around like a loser. Notice anybody else getting off the road? Not likely. On my dying day, when I go, it'll be sitting upright behind the wheel. Check out Radio EcoShock, the planet's only all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org.
Dear young people,
don't vote.
Don't vote.
Everything's fine the way it is.
Trump, that was us.
He's our guy.
Tax cuts for the rich? Hell yeah, I'm rich as fuck.
Climate change? That's a you problem. I'll be dead soon.
Sure, school shootings are sad.
But I haven't been in a school for 50 years.
I can't keep track of which lives matter.
Sure you don't like it.
So, you'll like some meme on Instagram.
If the weather is nice, maybe you could go to one of those little marches.
You might even share this video on Facebook.
But you won't vote.
You young people never do.
But I do. I do.
I do. Midterms, primaries.
Every single election.
We'll be there. But you won't.
Because we're a generation of doers.
Not whiners.
And we're doing great.
And coming up next Saturday evening,
hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
Next, we'll have the latest headlines from today's Democracy Now! And a short musical interlude. Followed by that, we're going to have a unique hour of This Can't Be Happening at thiscan'tbehappening.net with Dave Lindorf and John Grant, both live today. We'll be discussing an upcoming film produced by Lindorf. In the meantime, here's the latest headlines from Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Ukraine, at least 19 people were killed and dozens more left injured Monday as Russia's military continued to rain bombs and missiles down on cities. The Kremlin said the long-range airstrikes were aimed at Ukraine's energy and military infrastructure in retribution for a weekend explosion that damaged a key bridge linking Russia to Crimea, the Ukrainian territory annexed by Moscow in 2014. Russian President Vladimir Putin has blamed Ukraine for the blast, calling it an act of terrorism. This morning, Ukraine's military claimed to have shot down several Russian cruise missiles. Russia's latest strike came as the UN General Assembly gathered for an emergency session Monday, ahead of a vote later this week on whether to accept Russia's annexation of four partially occupied territories of Ukraine. Poland's UN ambassador was among those urging member states to vote no.
Not condemning the attempted annexation means weakening the UN Charter and weakening the whole UN system. One cannot expect UN institutions to function efficiently if one votes not accordingly to the very foundation they were established upon.
Today, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is holding virtual talks with leaders of the G7, including President Joe Biden and UK Prime Minister Liz Truss. It's expected Zelensky will ask for even more heavy weaponry, including advanced air defense systems. The leader of Belarus said Monday he will deploy a joint military task force with Russia near Belarus's border with Ukraine. President Alexander Lukashenko said he'd agreed to the deal during a meeting last weekend with Russian President Vladimir Putin in St. Petersburg. Lukashenko announced the troop movements as he warned NATO not to station nuclear weapons in Poland, suggesting he may be preparing to allow Russia to deploy nuclear arms to Belarus.
Military and political leaders of NATO and several European countries are already openly considering options of possible aggression against our country, including launching of a nuclear strike. Tell the president of Ukraine and other lunatics, if any of them are still there, that the Crimean Bridge will seem to them like a walk in the park if they ever touch a single meter of our territory with their dirty hands.
In Venezuela, at least 36 people were killed by devastating floods over the weekend in the north-central state of Aragua. 56 people remain missing. Venezuelan Vice President Delcy Rodriguez said the equivalent of 1 month of rain fell in 8 hours. In Central America, Tropical Storm Julia brought intense rainfall to regions already saturated by weeks of heavy rains, triggering flooding and mudslides that killed at least 28 people in Guatemala and El Salvador. Meanwhile, a new joint report from the United Nations and the Red Cross warns that current rates of greenhouse gas emissions are set to drive more intense heat waves that'll cause large-scale suffering and loss of life across huge swaths of Africa and Asia, where human life could become unsustainable by mid-century. The report warns heat waves will add to mass migration and further entrenched inequality, impacts that are already emerging today. The UN's High Commissioner for Refugees has made an urgent appeal for funding, warning of severe cuts unless his agency raises another $700 million by the end of the year. Filippo Grandi said Monday Russia's invasion of Ukraine had pushed the number of people forcibly displaced from their homes worldwide to more than 100 million. He said that's led the UN Refugee Agency's annual budget to balloon to over $10 billion.
And while the Ukraine response has been and must continue to be well-funded, this has to be the target for all operations. Funding for new emergencies like Ukraine needs to be in addition to, not instead of the others.
In Haiti, several people were shot Monday, at least one of them fatally, after police fired tear gas on thousands of protesters who took to the streets of the capital, Port-au-Prince. Protesters demanded the resignation of the U.S.-backed Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, and called on the government to reverse its decision to seek foreign military assistance.
Unemployment, the high cost of living, insecurity, it is all for these reasons that I am in the street. I take to the streets to say no to the occupation.
The United Nations is urging the activation of a rapid action force to Haiti to combat armed gangs that have blockaded the main terminal in Port-au-Prince, blocking imports of food, fuel, and other necessities. This comes amidst warnings of a looming public health disaster as a new outbreak of cholera emerged this month. In 2010, UN peacekeepers inadvertently sparked a cholera outbreak that killed 10,000 people, and UN forces in Haiti have been accused of sexual violence. In the occupied West Bank, a 12-year-old Palestinian child died Monday, 2 weeks after being shot and seriously wounded by Israeli forces during a raid in the Jenin refugee camp in late September. Mahmoud Mohammed Samoudi was at least the 165th Palestinian killed by Israeli soldiers in the occupied West Bank and Gaza this year alone. At least 44 of those killed were children. Mexico has filed another lawsuit against 5 U.S.-based firearm dealers responsible for fueling the flow of illegal weapons and a surge of murders in Mexico. Foreign Relations Secretary Marcelo Ebrard said Monday the new lawsuit targets 5 gun shops based in Arizona that have made firearms widely accessible to straw buyers who then help smuggle them into Mexico. He said in recent years, about 60% of the weapons seized in Mexico were traced back to 10 U.S. counties, mostly along the U.S.-Mexico border. This comes after a U.S. federal court in late September dismissed a separate $10 billion lawsuit Mexico filed last year against U.S.-based gun manufacturers. In Thailand, Families of the victims of last week's massacre at a child care center gathered at Buddhist temples this morning to mark the end of 3 days of funeral ceremonies honoring their loved ones. A 34-year-old former police officer fatally shot and stabbed at least 36 people, including 24 children, at the Young Children's Development Center last Thursday. It's the deadliest mass shooting in Thailand's modern history. Meanwhile, two U.S. journalists who work for CNN apologized for their coverage of the deadly attack after entering the building where the killings happened without permission. Thai press groups accused CNN reporter Anna Corrin and cameraman Daniel Hodge of breaching journalistic ethics. In Ohio, U.S. Senate candidates squared off in a Monday evening debate that will help determine the balance of power in the next Congress. Republican venture capitalist J.D. Vance repeatedly defended the actions of Donald Trump, whose endorsement helped propel Vance to victory in Ohio's Republican primary last May. He faces Democratic Congressmember Tim Ryan, who accused Vance of having his dignity taken away from him by the former president. In Georgia, new details have emerged about how Republican Senate candidate Herschel Walker paid for a girlfriend's abortion in 2009. The anti-choice Republican has denied the reports despite the existence of copious evidence. And over the weekend, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported text messages have emerged showing Walker's wife reached out to the ex-girlfriend. Walker has publicly called for a total ban on abortions without exceptions for rape, incest, or the help of the mother. This comes as Democrats hope to harness voter anger over the Supreme Court's June ruling allowing states to ban abortion. In Wisconsin, Democrat Mandela Barnes is hoping to unseat Republican incumbent Ron Johnson to become the state's first ever African-American U.S. senator.
If I were in the U.S. Senate, I would absolutely vote to codify Roe versus Wade to protect the right to an abortion and the right to choose into law once and for all to protect women's rights.
The president of the Los Angeles City Council, Mary Martinez, has stepped down from her leadership role after she was recorded saying racist remarks against Black and Indigenous people. Martinez made the comments last year on a phone call discussing redistricting with council members Kevin DeLeon and Gil Cedillo, as well as L.A. Labor Federation President Ron Herrera, who has also just resigned his post. It's unclear who recorded the call or who leaked it to the media, but it comes just weeks before voters head to the polls in Los Angeles to pick a new mayor. We'll have more on this story after headlines. In labor news, unionized railroad maintenance and construction workers have rejected a tentative deal with railroad carriers, renewing the possibility of a nationwide strike. The tentative agreement between unions and railroad carriers was brokered last month with the help of the Biden administration's Presidential Emergency Board. It would add one additional paid day off and allow workers to take unpaid days to get medical care without being penalized by their employers. Workers have denounced a lack of any paid sick time. The deal also included a pay raise of about 20% by 2024. The rail carriers have seen their profits soar in recent years while workers' wages remain stagnant. And renowned defense lawyer Billy Southern has died by suicide. He was 45 years old. Southern became known for defending low-income people across what's known as the Death Belt, a region stretching from Alabama to East Texas where death penalty cases are prevalent. Southern took up some of the toughest cases, including the wrongful conviction of Albert Woodfox, a former Black Panther who spent nearly 44 years in solitary confinement for a crime he always said he did not commit. Democracy Now! Spoke to Billy Southern in 2016 when Albert Woodfox was released from prison.
If you look back through the course of Albert's case, we see the suppression of evidence by the prosecution. We see ineffective assistance of counsel for people who can't afford their own lawyers. We see an appellate process that's incredibly resistant to providing new trials, even when it's the manifest and right thing to do. So while, of course, it's amazing that after 43 years, Albert Woodfox is now out of prison, it's also horrifying that it took 43 years for this injustice to be corrected.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Coming up at the top of the hour, we'll have John Grant Live, and I think we're going to have Dave Lindorf. We're going to see. Featured musician in this break, runs about 10 minutes, Pete Seeger.
I've traveled around this country from shore to shining shore. It really made me wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer a plowing sod and loam. I heard the auction hammer just a knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door. And the vaults are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for. I've seen the seamen standing idly by the shore, and I heard their bosses saying, got no work for you no more. But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door. And the vaults are stuffed with silver that the seamen sweated for. I've seen the weary miner scrubbing coal dust from his back, and I've heard his children crying, got no coal to heat the shack. But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the miner sweated for. I've seen my brothers working throughout this mighty land. I prayed we'd get together and together make a stand. Then we might own those banks of marble with a guard at every door. And we would share those vaults of silver that we have sweated for.
Mighty cities, mid the roar of whirling wheels, we are toiling on like chattel slaves of old. And our masters hope to keep us ever thus beneath their heels, and to coin our very lifeblood into gold. But we have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem when each man can live his life secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor and there's joy and peace for all in the commonwealth of toil that is to be. They would keep us cowed and beaten, cringing meekly at their feet. They would stand between each worker and his bread. Shall we yield our lives up to them for the bitter crust we eat? Shall we only hope for heaven when we're dead?
But we have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem when each man can live his life secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor and there's joy and peace for all in the commonwealth of toil that is to be.
They have laid our lives out for us to the utter end of time. Shall we stagger on beneath their heavy load? Shall we let them live forever in their gilded halls of crime, with our children doomed to toil beneath their gold?
But we have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem when each man can live his life secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor and there's joy and peace for all in the commonwealth of toil that is to be.
When our cause is all triumphant and we claim our Mother Earth and the nightmare of the present fades away, we shall live with love and laughter, men who now are little worth, and we'll not regret the price we have to pay.
But we have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem when each man can live his life secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor and there's joy and peace for all in the commonwealth of toil that is to be.
Solidarity forever.
Shall run. There can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes.
It is we who plow the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving mid the wonders we have made, but the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
Taken untold millions that they never toiled to earn, but without our brain and muscle not a single wheel can turn. We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever.
In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of Adam, magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, for the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side? He'll be with you, fellow workers, until this battle's won. Tell me, which side are you on? Be a man.
Yeah, that is. I can't say. Well, I can say that they're We have trees growing all over the place that they were planted by bird shit.
All right. Well, the birds certainly spread it around. Little turds.
Most of them are probably mulberries because we have a lot of mulberries. Okay. I mean, our driveway.
Well, they like to eat the mulberries. They eat the mulberries and then shit the seeds out. Right. Yeah.
Now we have 10 acres of mulberries, which are really not really good, great trees. I mean, but they're very they're indigenous. There's more indigenous mulberries than there are indigenous people here in Kansas anymore. So, let me see something here. I might see if we can get Dave on air. We'll just get him. We'll just bug him.
Dave, is Dave ringing up there or what?
No, he hasn't rang up yet, but I'll. You know, your brother, you know, Mike, you know, I will.
My brother.
I have ways of getting hold of people, that even when they don't want to get a hold of, especially when I am what Ed Asner once called a Marilyn Monroe moment, when I'm half-crocked, you know. And
yeah, your buddy Ed Asner there, right? Yeah. Hello, Mike. Mike?
I'm still here. I'm still here.
Okay, my bad. Speaking of trees, though, we have this tree in the backyard, this tulip poplar.
Oh, yeah.
It's a huge tree. I planted it too close to my backyard garage there. I should have planted it 5 feet a little farther away, but it just... It takes over the entire backyard. So, and I trim the leaves, the branches at the bottom. So it's this giant umbrella in our backyard that we, we sit in on chairs in the rain. We can sit underneath it all, you know. Anyway, trees. I'm into trees. Yeah. So, anyway. Well, today's paper, of course, the usual story on Russia is unleashing a deadly barrage against civilians in Ukraine.
You don't want to blow up the bridge. You don't want to blow up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Pardon? Mike?
I'm jumping back and forth. I'm trying to get Lindorf on the phone. I got an answer. They poked a. You don't stick a stick in a Russian bear's eye.
That was quite a coup. That bridge. I used to fish on the 7 mile bridge in the Keys, the Florida Keys, and that was a huge long bridge. This bridge is 12 miles long, and how can you secure a 12-mile bridge that, you know, all you need to do and is have a truck full of, like, fertilizer explosives, which I think they did.
Well, hey, I think we do have Dave on the phone. But, hey, you know, the thing is, I heard that the guy blew himself up. Or he was duped into driving the truck and blew up.
It's funny about the Times and the news and the covering Ukraine. Or is, of course, if this were the Middle East, they would have emphasized that this was a suicide bomber, right? Well, this is a European war, so I heard nowhere the mention of a suicide bomber. But how the hell are you going to get a trailer truck full of a bomb out in the middle of a 12-mile bridge?
You're
not going to remotely blow it up. There's a driver to the goddamn thing, and if it's large enough, it's going to take the driver out. So, the Ukrainians arranged a suicide bomber to do that bridge.
And Dave's on. We're going to put Dave on here just a minute.
Yeah.
Or they could have duped the guy, and he could be just a driver. He's just driving around.
Well, that's rather insidious. Yes, you're right.
You're not
telling a person he's going to be a suicide bomber. You're just
right.
Not
exactly.
Here's
Dave. I think we got Dave.
Dave.
Yeah,
there.
I'm here.
Dave, were you there?
I just want to inject that it could be a Tesla truck, so and it was being driven remotely, and they didn't even need any fertilizer because they could have blown it up. They blow themselves
up. If that were the case, I think we'd have known about it.
They could have blown up the lithium battery, and that would be the explosion.
Yeah.
Well, whatever they did, it was quite the coup. They pulled it. It was like taking out the Russian battleship, And this was the last thing that Vladimir Putin needed was this.
The railroad's still running on the bridge, and there's one lane that they're still driving back and forth on it. Damage. But now they get
it's like San Francisco every day.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's like San Francisco every day.
Right.
Or Kansas City. Of course, it mm-hmm. the only body of water it crosses is the Missouri River. But there's always construction. So, Dave, you've got some big news for us on Tuesday here. Great. Yeah, big news. You got a movie called
The movie is playing all over. It's like I'm running between Philadelphia and Cambridge, England, where it's got festivals that are at the same time. And Chicago is also, I think, what's the date today? This is the 11th. This is Chicago's tomorrow. It's the mm-hmm. opening film for the Chicago Film Festival.
Wow.
They're having a block party outside of this big thing called the Music Box Theater on the waterfront, and it's sold out.
So Dave, just so we can get the information clear here, what's the name of the film?
It's called A Compassionate Spy.
Mm-hmm. And it's about what?
It's about the teenage Harvard junior physics major who was hired at Los Alamos in January 1944 to help get the bomb designed, and he worked for a year on the plutonium bomb, year and a half, and the implosion device, and the one that was used in the Trinity test and the Nagasaki bomb. And about 6 months in, he realized that the bomb was really not to target Germany, which was being defeated by then and was not going to get a bomb. And it became widespread knowledge among the scientists there that it was actually going to target the Soviet Union. And he decided that was horrible and that the U.S. having a monopoly on the bomb would be a disaster for the world. So he had to share the plans that he had for the bomb with the Russians.
And of course, unlike the Rosenbergs, who of course were executed, he was never revealed in any ways until.
Well, it's more complicated than that. I mean, he was the first person identified in the deciphered, captured Soviet spy cables as a spy by his name because of a mistake that the cabler or the author of the cable to Moscow included his name and his partner's name, Saville Sachs, the courier. And so they knew as of 1950 that he was a spy, and they called him in during the Rosenberg trial, exactly during the Rosenberg trial in March of 1951. The FBI agents picked him and his courier up in Chicago without either knowing the other had been picked up, and interrogated them in different rooms at the same time. And they denied everything. They didn't have lawyers. They denied everything. And then shortly after, the case went away, and there wasn't any further investigation until the 1960s. And therein lies a tale, why he didn't get prosecuted.
So in the 1960s, what kind of investigation did they put on them?
Well, I guess I have to say a little bit. The his brother, 11 years older than him, was a brilliant rocket scientist and was, by 1950, was in a top secret lab at Wright-Patterson Air Base as a major in the Air Force and was directing developing rocket engines for large missiles that would be able to carry nuclear bombs. And then he later was, in 54, the head of the Air Force's ICBM development program and invented the Minuteman missile. This was Ted's brother.
Incredible.
And so the reason that Ted never got arrested, I learned from getting the brother's FBI file and finding these letters between Hoover and the head of the Air Force Investigation Unit, was that the Air Force basically shut Hoover down. They didn't want Ted arrested or investigated because they would have lost their rocket scientist if that came out in the media. Remember, this was the middle of the McCarthy period.
You know, they didn't pursue him because they valued his work, even though he gave up the bomb information.
The Air Force felt like, wow, that's history, but we need this rocket scientist. And you know, with the McCarthy period, arguing that the military was filled with spies, and that the government was filled with spies. If Ted had been arrested, they would have, the press would have immediately found out that his brother was working on the ICBM project, and he would have been gone.
Wow!
So even though he wasn't a spy, the Air Force just told Hoover, "Look, we're investigating Ed. That's what we're going to do, not you." And if you want to question him about his brother, you can do it, but you can't talk about it, you can't do anything about it, and you can't ask him about himself. Mm-hmm. We're doing that. And
so,
and 2 weeks after they did that investigation of Ed, the Air Force promoted him to lieutenant colonel, and then later in the year to colonel.
Wow.
And put him in charge of the ICBM program. So it was a real thumb in Hoover's eye.
So now this, the person you're in the film is Ted. What's his last name?
Hall.
Ted Hall.
It was actually Holtzberg, but the brother decided, after trying to get jobs in New York during the 30s with a Jewish name, he couldn't do it as an engineer. So he said, I'm going to change my name, and I'm going to change my brother's name too.
How would you explain that? Go ahead.
Wait a minute. Let me help clarify, because there's an article in The Nation, feature article in The Nation.
Yeah, there is. January 4th.
And it's two thank you. I couldn't remember the date. But it's two January 4th of The Nation listeners. It's a front cover article. Wonderful article. Very in-depth. But it's two brothers. Ted is the older brother, and Ed is the
younger brother. Ed's the older brother.
And Ed is the one that's in the Air Force, and Ted is the one that escaped the United States to retire and teach in England. He was the one. He was involved in it, right? Tell us about that. That's a very strange thing.
He moved in 1962 to Cambridge and got a job in biophysics in Cambridge and worked there till like in his 70s. And he died in 1974 of kidney cancer, 1999.
Yeah, you met his widow, which is very surprising.
Well, she was the key to the story, because she lives in Cambridge and she's 93 now and dying to see the movie, or not dying to see the movie. And so I'm going to go see her watch it on the Saturday after this.
Well, I mean, I was sort of stunned by that fact that he somehow got out of the United States. Now, he was working at like Los Alamos, but his brother was working in rocket propulsion, for lack of better terms, right? I mean, it's sort of, so they both were deeply involved in the, go ahead.
Yeah, he was a fascinating guy. He was, the brother was in England repairing American and British bombers that were limping back across the channel after getting hit with shrapnel and, you know, anti-aircraft fire and shot by German Luftwaffe planes. And they'd limp across the channel, crash land in a field, and he would get them back in the air. He was really brilliant at how to fix them. And he wound up heading while he was a major there, he ended up heading the repair program for these bombers to get them back in the air.
I don't understand. So Ted, he continued to work on, you know, developing the U.S. bomb. While he had moral issues about the bomb, but he still...
He felt like the United States was a country that was not, he would say any country, but certainly the United States was showing itself to be not to be trusted to have a monopoly on the bomb after the war. I mean, they were already talking in 1940, late 44 and during 45, about using the bomb on Russia preemptively to prevent them from getting a bomb. And,
right.
you know,
I,
and,
yeah. Yeah.
and they would have used it. Yeah, I mean, he's right. I mean, they would have used it to dominate the world if they'd had it to themselves.
Right. But I don't understand why they kept the guy on, you know, after he betrayed their
oh, no,
deep,
no, they didn't.
Secrets.
They didn't learn about him until 1950.
Right, this was late 40s.
No, 1950. Right at 1950, they managed to translate that Russian cable, and
right.
and it was the first. It happened to be the first of 2,000 cables that they translated, and it happened to say that Theodore Kohl. They spelled his name wrong. They spelled it K H O L L, but they identified him as the son of a Russian immigrant furrier in Manhattan. So they figured it out. Who went to Harvard? You know, like so. There was enough identification that the misspelling didn't throw them off. And they
right,
named
but why,
it,
why do they keep him on after they realize that he just betrayed American secrets?
They didn't. They didn't. He was the Manhattan Project ended in 1946, and then he went to the University of Chicago. And then in 1950, they found that cable translation.
So they just
while
chose,
he was finishing
they
his
chose
doctorate.
Not to prosecute him for spying.
Yeah. Looking back, they didn't choose not to, but they were told they couldn't by the Air Force.
Because the Air Force still wanted to tap into his brilliance, or what?
No, they wanted his brother. They would have lost his brother.
Oh,
I'm
they wanted to
that,
keep his brother. I see. Okay.
Yeah,
right. Who,
the McCarthy period in the 50s.
Active duty military officer, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, in the and in the 1950s, you'll recall that McCarthy was building his whole career on arguing that there were hundreds of communists infiltrating the government and the military, and so they would he would have had a heyday with this relationship between the two brothers, and he would have run Ed Hall out on a rail, and the press would have eaten it up. So the Air Force realized that, and they just told Hoover, you know, shut up, don't leak it, don't say anything.
Well, I mean, it's kind
of, it's not
kind
a word
of,
out of this.
It's kind of progressive of the military in some bizarre way, you know. We'll keep the guy on, even though he gave our darkest, you know, secrets away.
But he didn't. They didn't keep Ted on.
I mean, the brother, you're saying the brother was not a spy in any way.
No. No, he wasn't. There was never any indication that he was a spy. The Air Force did a whole, you know, investigation of him, and they were convinced that he was a patriot, and probably was. He's pretty right wing.
Now, how does it seem that they chose not to prosecute Ted? I still don't understand why they didn't.
There were letters that between Hoover and the head of the Office of Special Investigations at the Air Force, which were in Ed's file. I saw them and read them, and they're in the Nation article, so you can read them. But basically, Hoover wrote in January 6th, 1951, to the head of the Air Force OSI, who was actually a former aide of his in the FBI, and he had recommended him to head the operation at the Air Force. And so he wrote him a friendly letter and said, "I'm writing to alert you that that your Major Nathaniel Hall is the brother, older brother of a known atomic spy at Los Alamos, and we would like to question him about his brother." And then, like in March, there's another letter from Hoover saying to this director, whose name was General Joseph F. Carroll, C-A-R-R-O-L-L, and they say, he says, "Dear General Carroll, in reference to my January 6th letter, you sent a reply on January 18th saying that you were going to handle the investigation of Ed Hall yourself." And he said, "Our investigation of Ted Hall has reached a point." They had just, this was written 11 days after they had interrogated Ted for 3 hours. He said, "Our investigation of Ted has reached a point where we urgently need to question Ed Hall, and I would like your permission to question him." Mm-hmm. And instead of responding urgently, what happened was he gave them permission. I don't get the FBI didn't give me the letters from the reply letters from General Carroll, but the result of that letter was that on June 12th, 3 months later, which is not urgently responding, he did have two agents from Cincinnati FBI office question Ed in the presence of an OSI officer. So, right. You know, they were monitoring it, that he was only supposed to question Ed about him, his brother, and not about himself. Mm-hmm. So they didn't ask him any questions about himself. I have the report, you know, the FBI interview right. report. And he insisted he didn't know anything about his brother being a spy. And they asked him to convince his brother to cooperate with the FBI, and he said he would go talk with them. But, of course, he was very close with him, so that's not what he told him to do. But at any rate, and he lied about his relationship with his brother and said they hadn't been close right. since
so
the start of the war. So yeah.
I understand the film is going to be here in Philadelphia at the Philadelphia Film Festival. Is that correct?
Yeah, on the 25th at 1 o'clock, I'm going to be able to host
Q&A.
Of
this month?
Yeah. Yeah.
Good.
I'm going to be there. Yeah, it's $15 for cranky seniors.
Okay, I can handle that. Yeah. So now, okay, just, you know, sure to bring this up to date, you know, now that Russia has the bomb, and, you know.
Since 49, they've had it.
Well, I know. I obviously know that. But now, of course, the Russian nuclear capacity is an issue in the Ukraine war. It's constantly being, you know, held over the Ukraine war. Not that, you know, this is all necessarily connected, but, you know.
No, I think it's connected.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here's what I would say to that. First of all,
okay.
the result objectively did, for sure, is he prevented he gave the schematics for the plutonium bomb to the Russians. So he
right.
he basically gave them everything they needed to build the plutonium bomb. And in doing that, although another guy gave it too, and that's important, Klaus Fuchs, because the Russians were paranoid that this Baroque methodology for exploding plutonium, which is really complicated, was a Rube Goldberg creation designed to throw them off. And so the fact that two of their spies were giving them the same information, and that they knew, because they knew how these spies were being run and how they had been brought in the first place, that neither of them knew the other one at all. So when they got two sources that said the same thing, it allowed the head of their program, their Oppenheimer, a guy named Igor Korchatov, to go to Stalin. As a young guy, like Oppenheimer, he was like 39 years old, and for him to go to Stalin and say, you know, whatever they call him, you know, comrade or sir comrade, you know, you need to have the program cancel any effort to make a uranium bomb because we don't have the wherewithal to do it, and we have the plans for the plutonium bomb, so you need to give us permission to focus on all efforts, all staff, all finances on developing the plutonium bomb as quickly as possible. And Stalin agreed. So he said, you get whatever you need, do it. And so that's how they got it in 4 years, with a much smaller staff, no money, and a destroyed infrastructure.
Right. Well, the Russian bomb right now, they've, of course, developed, as we have, you know, tactical bombs that are A-bombs that are, you can take out a base, basically, or a small base or something with it.
You can take out a couple city blocks. They can make them really small.
Yeah, I mean, serious things. Well, that, the Russian tactical nuclear weapon is now what is restraining this war from reaching into Russia, basically. I mean, because it's
absolutely,
you know, so
well,
the bomb is a defensive thing for them right now.
I would say that the strategic weapons are what are preventing any attacks inside Russia, because if there was an attack across the border, that would quickly expand into a strategic nuclear exchange.
Right. Well, now,
so
Ukraine,
the question
of course,
is,
gave up
does
all
Russia...
its nuclear weapons. Am I correct?
Pardon?
You know, I mean, Ukraine had nuclear weapons that they voluntarily gave them up. Am I correct? I'm not
sure. Yeah,
that was
part of the deal for their getting separated when the Soviet Union broke up.
Right, right. Well, that's... I mean, it's interesting when you put it all in this context of atomic weaponry, that what atomic weapons, or, you know, the tactical ones are doing to put limits on this war, at least limits on one side of the war.
Well, here's what I would argue, John.
Okay.
That first of all, there were, you know, the fact that Ted gave the bomb to the Russians prevented the U.S. from a plan that they had, that Truman had ordered, for a 400-bomb preemptive attack on Russia to make it impossible for them to ever produce a bomb. And this was a attack that was going to happen when the U.S. had 400 bombs, because that's what the Pentagon strategist said would be required.
So you're saying that Harry Truman had a plan and intended to throw 400 nuclear weapons into Russia?
Yeah, and the evidence of that is this. The documents are there that he asked the Pentagon how many bombs would it take to destroy Russia as an industrial society. And they told him 400, and they said they needed 400 because they would have to drop multiple bombs of the Nagasaki size on the larger cities, and they also would have to hit all the Red Army bases to prevent Russia from responding by sending the Red Army to overrun Western Europe.
Harry Truman had no concern for the fallout blowing around the world from 400 nuclear weapons? I mean,
nope.
They
didn't
really
give
that blasé about it?
They did not give a shit, John, and what they didn't want was Russia to have the bomb. And not only that...
Right, I understand that. Of course they didn't.
Get this. Not only that, but the United States started designing a hydrogen bomb before they even dropped the bomb on Japan and on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Yeah. They already were starting work to develop the hydrogen bomb.
Well, they have contingency plans for everything, including Martian attacks.
This is not, these were not contingency plans. They were operational plans. And they started making an assembly line to build atomic bombs of both types, uranium and plutonium, as fast as they could right when the war ended. At the time the war ended, the bombs were being made by hand, right? And it was very slow. They didn't have another bomb when they dropped the Nagasaki bomb. And so that's why they were concerned that they needed to work, because they didn't have any more.
So this is basically an extension of, Patton's state of mind. I guess Patton's state of mind, they said, was he wanted, well, let's not stop. We got the Germans. Let's go get the Russians.
Yeah. Well, that's right.
But he
General Groves,
arguably murdered. But we don't.
Yeah.
I mean, these
guys were sick. General Groves, who was the general in charge of the Manhattan Project, was invited to a dinner by the British mission of scientists who had come over at the beginning of 1944 to join forces with the U.S. and stop trying to develop their own bomb in England, which they didn't have the resources to do. So they came over to Los Alamos, and they were headed up by a Nobel physicist from England. And at his house at Los Alamos, he hosted a dinner for, the high mucky mucks at like Oppenheimer and stuff at the Manhattan Project. And at that dinner, General Groves, when they were having dessert, was in the discussion, and people were saying, a lot of the scientists were getting upset because Germany had surrendered already. And they were saying, why are we still building the bomb? This was for, to beat the Germans. And General Groves said, gentlemen, this bomb was not being designed to attack Germany. It was very unlikely that it was going to be used against Germany. The target of this bomb is the Soviet Union. So at that point, a Polish-British dual citizen named Josef Rotblat, he said, I'm done. I'm not going to participate in this. And then, so they investigated him, and they wouldn't let him leave the country. And it took about a year for him to get out of the country. And they kept all his books and papers, and because they didn't trust that he wouldn't, do what Ted did. But he was much older and more, the older guys were more cautious. Like, they went and talked to Roosevelt and said, you got to bring the Russians in. Remember, Russia was fighting the war. They were our ally.
I know the history.
So a lot of these scientists, including, a lot of Eastern European scientists, were really upset with what was being done. And Ted was one of them. But Ted was the difference between them and Ted is that Ted was an 18-year-old kid who didn't have impulse control, and he just said, well, what has to be done has to be done, and
right.
I'll do it.
Makes sense, yeah. Well, okay. It's an amazing subject of a film, so I'm looking forward to seeing it. But then we're talking about Russia, and of course, every day on the New York Times, it's like five pages of news out of the war in Ukraine, which I know is not directly a result in any way, shape, or form of the story you're telling about Ted, but it's just...
Well, I think it is, though. I think it is part of the story because of what Ted did. Ted thought that if he gave the Russians the bomb, it would be like after World War I, when they saw the horrors of the chemical warfare, and the chemical warfare got banned by the world. And he thought that, when people saw the horrors of that nuclear bombs would cause, that the world would you know, Russia and the U.S. would get together and the rest of the world, and they'd ban nuclear weapons. But instead, the U.S. started pushing for making more and bigger bombs, and the Russians pushed to catch up, which they never did. But they always kept close enough that they couldn't get attacked. And so we had this enormous, expensive, scary arms race. But for 77 years after Nagasaki, there hasn't been an atomic bomb exploded in war, which is quite an accomplishment, you know. So it's not the accomplishment Ted wanted.
So far, you know, Vladimir Putin has not, you know, is so far it's just a bluff. They keep calling this bluff, you know, by like bombing this bridge and things like that.
It would be quite
a world event, and everybody's sort of preparing for it. If, you know, the first atomic bomb used in war since Hiroshima, you know,
Nagasaki.
Could be in 2020 or Nagasaki in 2022 in Europe, you know, in Ukraine. It just opens up a brand new world of hell that, you know, I mean, it had been balanced, you know, obviously maybe you're right because of Ted's work and that. Yes, there is this, you know, mutual assured destruction that, you know, that both sides, all sides always obeyed, you know, so far we haven't, like you say, we haven't had another nuclear explosion. It's on the table as a threat, you know, so it's,
it's been a threat before, John.
We've been since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, actually not. The closest we came was 1983. There was a recent article about it. You remember the KAL shoot down? The Korean airline over Sakhalin?
Yeah, okay.
I do.
Yeah, at that time, the U.S. was engaged in the largest ever joint NATO war games plan involving almost 100,000 troops of the NATO alliance countries in Western Europe, moving right up to the East German border and, you know, everywhere in NATO. And the Russians, we know this now from the reports that came out of Russia during Glasnost and also, you know, cables that have been translated and been released in the U.S. and national security documents, that the Russians thought that because of Reagan being the president and casually talking about them as an evil empire, that the war games in Europe were a cover for a real plan for a preemptive attack on them. And so they were on hair trigger alert all across the Soviet Union and in the Warsaw countries. And the U.S. didn't know this. And so the Russians were getting ready to launch a preemptive attack if they thought the U.S. was really going to attack. So you had this whole thing going on in Europe in the 80s of, you know, with Russia trying to figure out if the U.S. was really planning to attack them, and the U.S. wondering why the Russians were moving, large equipment around inside the Soviet Union. So they're both being really edgy.
Brinksmanship and poor communication.
But it came within minutes of launching from Germany, because a general there thought that it was, you know, getting to the point where he just had to act on his own. As Ellsberg pointed out, the individual commanders have the launch authority.
The world is lucky it didn't. The buttons didn't get pushed.
Yeah,
I guess we're hoping right now the buttons don't get pushed. You know,
the U.S. came very close to using. They shipped the nukes to Da Nang that the military wanted to use to rescue
the
Marines at Khe Sanh.
The worst in the world. I know that. Okay.
No. I'm just telling you. The U.S. moved bombs to Da Nang to be delivered to rescue the Marines who were trapped at Khe Sanh.
I mean, we can talk about history all the way to the 40s to the 50s, 60s, 70s, but I'm talking about right now. I think the world is in a precarious position right now like it's never seen. And, you know, it is, you know, getting worse and worse. And it involves Russia and involves, you know, nuclear weapons and things like that, the same sort of, you know, formulas here at this particular bizarre position we're in right now.
There was an article in the Wall Street Journal by a retired general, I think it was a Navy general, who said that, you know, the U.S. doesn't have to respond to a Russian tactical nuke used in Ukraine, but it could use a non-nuclear attack to respond that would alert them that they shouldn't do it again. And he suggested sinking having a U.S. attack sub sink a Russian missile sub in the Atlantic, and, you know, with a conventional torpedo.
Yeah, well, I mean, now you're talking about the, you know, the walk up to World War III. Yeah, I mean, we've seen this before.
Yeah, exactly. It's called the escalation ladder.
Exactly. No,
and the thing I'm afraid of. Well, here's the thing that, and here's why I don't think it'll happen, that the armies of China and the U.S. and Russia have all wargamed all these scenarios over and over, and every time, from what I've read, every single wargame that's been played that involves using nuclear weapons escalates within days into a strategic nuclear war.
Right. I read the same thing. Right. I know.
And so because of that, I think that Putin is bluffing.
I do
because,
too. I think
because
you're right.
Even if he's a nut job, he has to be a babe for this to happen. And I don't think that the military wants to commit suicide in Russia.
No, I don't either. But they're just savagely bombing civilians and things like that in Ukraine.
Oh, they're going to do that. I mean, they're in it to win it, but I don't think they want to have Russia.
No, they're not winning it very good, and that's what they're painting themselves into this desperate corner. That's what's sort of frightening.
Yeah, what I find outrageous is that the American people are not having a say in how far this country is committing itself to the
right of
a country that we have no treaty with to have its territorial integrity kept sacred, or its freedom to join NATO if it wants to be sacrosanct. I mean, I didn't say that I think I want to have the world annihilated for Ukraine. I think they've behaved incredibly stupidly since 2014 when they overthrew their elected government.
Why was that stupid?
Why the hell should we all destroy ourselves
Why was that stupid? Who was being stupid?
I think Ukraine behaved very incredibly stupid being next to Russia.
You mean they should have bent over, or what are you saying?
No, I'm saying they had a president that was elected by the people of Ukraine, and they overthrew it. And the U.S. backed it and maybe helped foment it.
Well,
certainly
the guy was a notorious, pardon the expression, pig fucker, but
there's so many of those in our circle in Latin America. We're not able to talk. Come on. I mean, that's not a grounds for saying that we should risk a nuclear war. I said in my article in the current issue of This Can't Be Happening that Americans have a right to decide how far are we supposed to go. Do we want American troops dying in Ukraine for Ukrainians? No.
Well, see,
here's
where you get to my position on this. And I'm sorry, Mike, we're sort of taking this over. Mike, how you doing over there?
I'm listening. Go ahead. Everyone else is listening too. Go ahead.
But I just had an exchange this morning with some people in Vets for Peace who are, I think, apologist somewhat for Putin and all of that. I wonder, you know, I tend to watch like Tucker Carlson, and I see Glenn Greenwald on there. I see Tulsi Gabbard on there, and I see these linkages between the populist right and the populist left. Both hate the deep state, and have this sort of affinity that is expressed in this bizarre and dangerous Ukraine war. So I don't see why, and this is what I've been suggesting, and I don't know quite how one would develop this, but there is definitely a real fledgling anti-war movement about this specific war in Russia that's developing. There are even some of Putin's allies who are attacking him and questioning him and things like that. And, you know, there may be, like there was in Israel and places like that, there may be some disgruntled Russian troops and things that might be able to speak outside of Russia or something. So I don't see why, like these people I know in Vets for Peace and other people who tend to hate the U.S. deep state so much that they sort of give a break to Putin and his side. So they're kind of becoming participants in the war in some way. And in fact, I just read a full speech that Putin made in which he starts talking about American gender confusions and all the right-wing stuff about gender confusions. You know, he's trying to lure the right wing into his position. So why don't the American, like especially Vets for Peace elements that are interested in this, why don't they make some effort to, instead of, you know, sort of, you know, making apologies for Vladimir Putin and his gang of cruelty, why don't they align the frustrated American peace movement with this fledgling Russian peace movement and, like, have a press conference outside the UN and say a plague on both their houses? We want negotiations. We want this fixed. You know, I don't...
Well, I'll tell you why. Because
yeah,
the worst thing the U.S. could do, or the U.S. Left could do, is have, you know, the peace movement in the U.S., you know, linking up with the Russian peace movement, because that would be seen
as... Why would that be the worst thing in the world?
Because that would make the Russian peace movement toxic within the Russian country. If the Russians have an indigenous...
It's not toxic already?
Listen, if the Russian peace movement is indigenous and doesn't have connections with U.S. peace movement, the Russian people are very sympathetic to it. Right now, they really are. I mean, the vast majority of Russians don't want this war. But if you take and the lead is being taken in the streets by peace protesters, some of them, you know, drafty, you know, threatened by draft and everything else. But it's just like here, you know, if they thought that the anti-draft movement was communist inspired, which they tried to claim, which it wasn't in the U.S., you know, we would have had more enemies of the peace movement here.
Well, they're already, the peace movement is already smeared with communism. I mean, my God, I mean, we're all communists now on the left, you know.
Yeah, they don't need, you know, whatever communism is.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Like, what, Laos and maybe Cuba are communists. I can't think of another communist country. But North Korea, I guess, if you could call that communism.
The point is, I don't understand why linking with the fledgling Russian peace movement would in any way harm us in the leftist movement here. I think it would actually...
No, it doesn't harm us. It harms the left and peace movement in Russia to have a link to the U.S. one for the same reason I just mentioned.
So basically you're saying the anti-war left movement in Russia is...
They're doing fine.
Along with
Putin
anyway. They hate Americans and all this stuff.
No, the Russian peace movement is indigenous, it's patriotic, they want the Russians out of Ukraine, and let them do it. Don't you know, muck it up by, you know, trying to unite with them, because that will make them toxic.
We're not communicating well here, I guess, because I don't understand what you're saying. I don't. It seems to me, and this may be my particular position here, feelings, that the anti-war movement, the peace movement in America is powerless these days. It's sort of,
That's our problem, though. That's not the Russians'
problem. Of course it's our
problem.
I'm saying, well, why would one want to exacerbate that problem by, sort of having sympathy for the gang that the U.S. is making war against, i.e. being Russia in this case.
I don't understand what you're saying, John.
Yeah, I know
I'm
we don't understand each other.
I'm saying
that's
something
problem,
completely
yeah.
different. I'm saying something completely different from you. I don't give a shit what the state of the U.S. peace movement is. That's not the problem. The problem is that the Russian peace movement is growing, and it's growing well. It's growing well on its own because of the existing problem of not wanting to be drafted and fight in a war they don't believe in.
Of course.
It's exactly like our peace movement in the Vietnam
era. Why wouldn't you, as an activist in the left, have sympathy for those folks?
I do.
Why won't you publicly say that then?
I do.
I'm very supportive of the Russian peace movement.
I have no
Mike,
John,
what do you think?
John,
Mike.
John. You don't know that what the peace movement is, because it's not pro Putin. The U.S. peace movement is not an apologist for Putin. The peace movement wants the U.S. to stop poking Russia and making it worse.
And so what? The U.S. peace movement doesn't give a rat's ass that Putin is cruelly blasting this place to smithereens?
Of course they do. They're calling for a ceasefire in place and negotiations.
Yeah.
That's every peace organization I've met has said
they're
that.
They're not
and that
getting
is the
very
only...
far with that request. That's my point.
No, because the U.S. keeps supplying more and more deadly and modern weapons to the Ukrainians.
Mike, what do you think? Come on, Mike. Tell me.
I think the American people have got to come to grips with the old man Republican said about the military-industrial complex, that we've got to stop funding. We've got to stop funding the Pentagon. And too many Americans are fat and indolent, and they suffer from a mental disease that's been a generational mental disease called anti-communism.
Amen, brother.
I think a lot of people are coming around. I hate to say this, but some of Trump's stump speeches that he's giving now, he of course is exaggerating his role and lying, but he's saying he would stop this in a minute. He didn't say how. He just said he would stop this in a minute.
He's probably bombing Zelensky anyway. You know, he doesn't care.
Excuse me. Well, I mean, the point is that he's already picked up, I think, on something that many people who are for peace, like myself, are not able or capable of communicating with the vast majority of people. Once again, who I think are generationally afflicted with a mental disease called anti-communism.
Most of them think
that Russia's communist.
Yeah, right.
No. Russia is a public-private gangster government.
Well, like ours. Okay.
Yeah, like ours.
It's not like ours.
Yes,
we do, whether you hate America or not. I'm kidding. We have a flawed democracy so far.
Well, we're running out of time.
I know. It's not perfect.
The movie
it's
is called the movie is called A Compassionate Spy, and I put links in the summary so you can go directly to today's article. One brother gave the Soviets the A-bomb. The other got a medal at the Nation magazine. There's links in the summary, listeners, and you can go right to it. It'll take you right to the article. It'll take to the IMDb page for A Compassionate Spy, which is being released on Hulu. Is it on? Is it released now, Dave? We got to close real quick.
No, that's not definite at all. There's a company that's interested in buying the distribution rights, but we haven't settled on one yet.
Well, I look forward to seeing the film at the Philadelphia Film Festival. Yeah.